is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. On the show today, I'm doing the first of a two-part recap of my 2015 shows. 2015 was a busier year than even last year for releasing brand new shows or episodes that had never been posted on the All About Jack hosting location. Nearly 40 shows fall under that category, as I released an average of actually more than one show a week when you count the re-releases. As you may know, in late July 2014, I changed to my current location of allaboutjack.podbean.com and have occasionally been sharing some programs that were at the old location because of gaining so many new listeners. I generally stuck with posting shows on Mondays in 2015, with a few exceptions. Most were when I actually shared more than one podcast during the week. This happened sometimes when I had a guest for a new book and I realized a previous interview wasn't reposted yet. But more frequently, it was because of the 65th anniversary of the first Narnia story. This resulted in me sharing a couple of series related to that subject, but I won't be talking about that anymore for this first recap. You'll need to listen to the second recap show when it's released to find out about them. In this first of two shows reflecting on only the newer shows I posted in 2015, I will look back on episodes through about mid-July because that covers about half the shows that were new to the All About Jack hosting location. Technically, this actually means 21 shows, but one of them was a recap of a couple events happening during 2015. The first new show for 2015 wasn't about a new book, but it was the first time Dr. Wayne Martindale was on my show. He was involved in the landmark book, The Quotable Lewis, but the focus for my interview was on his book from 2005 entitled Beyond the Shadowlands, C.S. Lewis on Heaven and Hell. In this excerpt, Wayne tells about just the first section of the book.
The first section is on a demythologizing, and that deals with Lewis's prose work on the subject of, in this case, we're talking about heaven. And in his fiction, he remythologizes. So the second section is on Lewis's mythology about heaven. That term myth probably needs a little bit of explanation. He uses myth in three senses, two of them very common, one just to mean something that is false. Second meaning is a body of work like Roman mythology or Greek mythology, which was believed at one time, but is no longer believed. The third sense is difficult because it's the opposite of the first two. It means something that gives, encapsulates values and belief systems, and something that is true, and that also gives us not just truth, but an experience of the thing it's trying to describe. So when Lewis writes Myths of Heaven, he's actually taking us imaginatively into some aspect of that world, while at the same time saying something true about it.
Next, I did a two-part show that was a roundtable discussion about the Hobbit movies versus the book. As you may know, Lewis was not only a friend of Tolkien, but one of the first to read the book before it was even published. I tackled this project in early January of 2015 because the third and final part of the movie version was released to theaters not long before that, and it seemed a good time to discuss the issue with three friends of mine. On the show were Dr. Charlie Starr, Dr. Crystal Hurd, and Britton Dickinson. Again, this was a two-part show, but here I'm only sharing the very first answer from that first show, which basically asked if their views had changed about the movies once seeing the third film. So you'll have to follow the link in the show notes to find out more completely what each of their views were. First, Charlie shares, then Crystal, and finally, Britton.
I would say that after the third movie, my opinion really didn't change much. It might be a little bit too early in our discussion to say what my opinion of the whole is, but the second movie really was sort of the outstanding movie in terms of creating conflicts, difficulties, things for me to have to think about. And the third film really just how's the best way to word it? It settled a lot of those problems by confirming them, and it also helped me avoid my worst case scenarios. So I've, after the third movie, my opinion hadn't really changed that much.
I must concur with Charlie here. My opinion did not change significantly from the second to the third film. I believe the second film was the strongest myself, not just because Smaug was incredible, but there were some, I feel like they didn't really tie up some ends. I think they left a lot of things unanswered, but overall, I believe I had, you know, similar impressions from the second to the third film.
Well, I actually brightened up a bit in the third film. When I list all the sort of cool things, I do get a lot out of the second film, but to me, the third film, I thought, was a bit tighter. If we're going to ask the question of the whole and its parts, I think that the individual parts are better than the whole, which is better than its parts, if that makes any sense. I think the strength of the film is actually super-duper scenes, and then the whole is better than all its individual parts after that. And so when we come to talk about individual scenes, to me, that's the more exciting part. And so the third film, for me, added more of those super-duper scenes. But overall, I feel about the same for the three films.
The next new show was about a retreat from Inklings Fellowship that they have each year in Montreat, North Carolina. Because the event has passed, I won't share an excerpt here, but be aware that they have a new one for 2016, that is April 1st through the 3rd weekend. The theme for that one is The Devil and C.S. Lewis, and I'm actually going to be one of their keynote speakers, as my new book, C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, will just be out by then. On February 9th, I shared a show that told about a new release from Logos Bible Software called the C.S. Lewis Collection. In this clip, I had the guest tell about the advantages of that software, and his comments also spoke of how it relates to having the 30 Lewis titles in their collection, but you'll have to check the show notes again for more details, and there's a link about that episode in the notes to discover what those titles are.
So Logos Bible Software, over 24 years ago, really was developed for people who love to read the Bible, love to study, get into God's Word, and kind of do more than just reading, but jump in deeper into the study aspect to help them become more efficient and effective in their study. And so over 24 years, of course, we've expanded, we've grown. The company now has over 500 employees. We're located in Bellingham, Washington, about an hour and a half north of Seattle, grown to about four different buildings. And so through it all, we've actually been able to grow our library immensely. And so we're excited to be able to now provide collections of resources that will aid you in your study and specific research in various capacities. So for instance, the ability, and you mentioned it already, to search specific collections of resources or books. So you're not flipping pages and spending hours and hours of time trying to get to that particular section or paragraph. You can just type in a search field and say, hey, I want to see every time C.S. Lewis talks about glory or joy, and you just get right to that section. And then also linking all of our resources with each other. So if C.S. Lewis ever makes a mention in his personal memoirs or letters to a specific work that he's working on, we'll actually link you directly to that resource. So you don't have to worry about jumping to a different book and trying to get there. We'll give you a preview and ability to go directly there. And then the historical pieces as well, so that you've got all the kind of historicity behind all of his works, all plotted out in a timeline. And so needless to say, people who love to read, study, write, blog, will absolutely be blown away with the ability that Logos has to make you more efficient. Plus, we do automatic footnote citations and your bibliography for you.
The next new episode wasn't until March 2nd when I shared about the then latest issue of Christian History Magazine about seven literary sages. These seven are the authors that are focused on in the Waite Center. In this excerpt, my guest tells about some of the contributors who have previously been a guest on All About Jack.
Well, Alistair McGrath was in an opening forum that we had in the issue. We had several people talking about the significance of the seven sages, their visions, why those visions are still important today. So Dr. McGrath was in that forum. Colin was in that forum. David Downing's wife, Crystal, was in that forum. Then Colin did for us several sidebars, one on the Inklings in particular, and one on Tolkien's views of subcreation, and he also contributed a number of his photographs to the issue. David Downing and Michael Ward did articles on Lewis's views of education, Michael from the UK context and David from the US context. Since those contexts are so different, we wanted to have two articles on that. So they both spoke about Lewis's views on education. And Michael also wrote a short sidebar on the 50th anniversary laying of the memorial stone in Westminster Abbey, which, by the way, I got to attend, and it was fantastic and amazing. And Michael has a small report on that and what was done and how the service proceeded. And they're all wonderful contributions, and I look forward to your listeners getting a chance to read them.
After doing a recap program on some events happening for 2015 that I won't repeat here, I then had Colin Duryea on the show again. This time he spoke about one of his new books for 2015. It's the one entitled The Oxford Inklings. In this short excerpt, I share some of his comments about Charles Williams.
Charles Williams was very important to the Inklings, but later on in the life of the group, particularly in the years of the Second World War. Now, as this book is a biographical, a group portrait of the Inklings, it takes a biographical approach, and what I'm doing, my strategy in the book, is to introduce the members gradually. Charles Williams was one of the firstborn of the Inklings, and so quite a lot of his life had passed by the time he actually joined the group. But at the same time, he indicates how much it's also an affinity, why he was drawn into the group in the first place. He wrote novels, and he wrote popular theology, and he was fascinated by the idea of romantic love as a key to understanding the relationship between human beings and God. And he had lots of other fascinating ideas as well, which deeply attracted C.S. Lewis in particular. So again, I thought that by introducing one of the firstborn of the Inklings, somebody who had very fascinating ideas that the group found intriguing, it would help in the gradual build-up of the understanding of what the group was all about.
I only had one new essay chat last year, but I did repost several more. The new one was with Brenton, who had been a guest earlier. We discussed Screwtape Proposes a Toast, an essay that was a follow-up to the classic The Screwtape Letters. In this clip, I share part of Brenton's answer about how Screwtape spends the lack of great sinners to feast upon.
It's a good question, and it's part of the humor, and you have to read Screwtape and Screwtape Proposes a Toast with a good deal of humor in mind. This is not just upside-down writing, but upside-down writing. So we're peeking underneath the tablecloth at least twice here. And so what he does, of course, is say, well, you know, it would be nice if we were all just here for a great meal. It would be nice to just feast on the best that we could have. And some of the examples that he gives, include, I believe, Mussolini, right? And we would know him. Perhaps we would even talk about Hitler. He mentions Henry VIII, probably somebody we wouldn't necessarily put as one of the greatest evil geniuses in history, but that's okay too, right? And so he says, yeah, we all enjoy that sort of a meal. And in Screwtape's world, they feast upon the souls of the sinners that they can coax into hell.
Next, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jerry Root about a book that wasn't due out until later in the year and is obviously out now. The book is co-authored with Mark Neal, and in this excerpt, he tells about how the idea for the book came about, and the book is called The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis.
Well, first off, in 45 years of reading Lewis, I found out not only is he a man of great imagination, Austin Farah, a fellow Inkling philosopher at Oxford University, said Lewis, though he was very logical and reasonable, his greatest gift was in depiction. His ability to create imaginatively images, metaphors, similes, analogies that would help his readers grasp some difficult concept. So he could give the skeletal structure propositionally and then flesh it out with some sort of imaginative depiction. Even Evelyn Underhill, when she wrote to him, He said, the greatest literary experience of my life was in receiving a letter from you. And she said, the great thing about you is that you are able to give imaginative embodiment to complex theological issues. So as I would read Lewis, I started seeing that he would say different descriptive terms about kinds of imagination. And over the years, I've collected about 32 of these. Now, they say the Eskimos have 30 different words for snow because they live in the snow and they see nuances that people who don't know the snow like they do. And the interesting thing, I tried to do some research and I found out there's about 9 Eskimo words for snow, but they add prefixes and suffixes onto those same 9 words and it comes to about 28 different words. So too, Lewis, as he comes up with these different words for the imagination, shows us a man who trafficked in the world of the imagination. Matter of fact, he even says in one of his letters, the imaginative man in me is older than the rational man and more continuously operative. So therefore, I felt like understanding these particular words it'd be a great thing to set forth for people who want to do more serious Lewis study and whatnot.
The first Monday in April, I shared a short paper I gave at the CSLIS conference earlier in the year. It was about quotations that are not quite Lewis, because even though he wrote it, out of context, it means something different. For this recap, I share a short part about an expression found in the Four Loves. Learn more about it by following the link in the show notes where other quotes are shared in that podcast.
Do not let your happiness depend on something you may lose. It says C.S. Lewis, it actually is. This does not mean what you might think it means. You know, is not trying to deal with the idea about worldliness and such. This is found, again, in the Four Loves. It is actually in the last chapter entitled Charity. Prior to this passage, Lewis has been discussing his view on natural loves and how they may become rivals to loving God. However, he believes that there is a greater danger to not being able to move from self-love to love towards others. Thus, our love has not risen to where it can become a rival. In fact, he points out many people do not find it really difficult to hate their wives or mothers because they're so much into their own self-love. So it's easy, you know, to follow that command because, they haven't moved beyond the self-love. All right, Lewis is suggesting here that we must first learn to love people on earth before really being able to love God. That's going to fit into the end of the quote here in a second if you follow me. This is the backdrop before in this chapter in the Four Loves, where Lewis is discussing a passage from St. Augustine, for which he disagrees. He finds an unsettling moral, that's how I'm summarizing it, but this is at the very outset. He is disagreeing with St. Augustine, which he says this is apparently the only issue that he finds a disagreement with.
Next, I shared some panels I moderated at a couple of events. The first features Dr. Diana Glier and Dr. Jerry Root. They answer a question about, because many consider Lewis an authority on Christianity, what authority does Lewis appeal to, and where can it be found in his works?
I'll answer briefly, and then I'll turn it over to the church historian to my right. But I think that part of the reason why we're a little puzzled by the question is I don't know that Lewis thought he did have authority. I don't know that he would characterize himself as an authoritative voice. I think he would characterize himself as an ordinary layman, simply doing what he knows how to do, simply doing his small best to articulate things. But more to your point, in Mere Christianity, Lewis says that everything that he has to say can be found in the creeds of the church. And so to the extent that he appeals to an authoritative text, he appeals to the creeds.
He's also, as far as his power as a writer, there's something authoritative about that, as well as being steeped in what I would call historic orthodoxy. As soon as he became a theist, he started reading the Bible regularly. He read it every day. He read in the English, different translations, and he read in the Greek every day. I think there's something that comes through. He doesn't. I'm a very conservative inerrantist. I don't, however, believe that the post-interpreted text is inerrant. I don't like people painting a thus saith the Lord across their interpretation of text, but I believe that the Bible's an inerrant text. Lewis didn't believe that. But there's a place where he says, Pascal and Scripture disagree. Pascal must clearly be wrong. So he has a high view of the authority of the Bible. Number two, he started going to chapel regularly. And he always stayed a churchman. So he believed that the voice that came down through the church was important. In the Greek, most of the yous are plural. It was never written to individuals. It was written to be understood in community. And Lewis was respectful of that. And he knew that. Next, as you mentioned, read so widely. You read English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. He read both sides of the Reformation thoroughly. He's the only one I know who's done that. Usually we pick up a guy we don't like on the other side and take them to task and all that sort of thing. He read thoroughly, and his judgments are measured. That gives anybody authority. They don't over-egg the pudding, they're not overstating, and so on. So he has measured judgments that are informed. Also, I think his read of language, he knew many languages, not like Tolkien, who learned a language a year, every year. Tolkien signed the contract to translate the book of Job in the Jerusalem Bible for the Catholic Church, and he hadn't even learned Hebrew when he signed the contract. He goes out and learns it. My Hebrew prof in grad school said he thought it was the best translation of Job in the English Bible, in any English Bible. So, I mean, Lewis wasn't that level, but he still knew many languages. And that meant that when he saw the cognitive relationships, he knew what the right word was to use. I think that gave him some sort of authority as he wrote about these things. But I think steeped in Scripture, steeped in historic orthodoxy, committed to the church, it was a faith commitment that also came through, and I think those kinds of things work.
Then for the next, I'm going to share the person asking a question to Dr. Don King and Dr. Crystal Hurd about Joy Davidman, who had been previously married before she wedded Lewis. For this and the previous panel, you need to follow the link in the show notes to obviously hear the rest, but also to learn more about the conferences that they originated from.
This is probably for Crystal or Dawn. In her poetry, Joy Davidman focused a lot on the imagery of love and the importance of recognition. How significant was her relationship with Bill when it came to the writing of her poetry?
As I recall, most of the writing that Joy was doing when she was working with Bill was not poetry. She collaborated with him a good deal on his prose, the work that he was doing. Certainly Bill would have known her poems through Letter to a Comrade, but I don't think Bill really probably had much influence on Joy's poetry other than poems that she wrote about him, and there are a few poems that she wrote about him. There's sort of a comic poem that she writes about the fact that, it's getting towards winter, Bill, things need to be fixed in the house, you need to get with it. It's not a cruel poem, but it's the kind of thing that wives sometimes have to do to husbands who are hanging back in terms of jobs they're supposed to do around the house. So I don't think that he had much influence on her poetry. I do think there are some poems that she wrote where she may have him in the back of her mind when she's writing some of her love poems. It'll be interesting for you as you read that volume to see where you think maybe she's got Bill in the back of her mind.
You know, if you've read Out of My Bone, which he edited, I think you see a lot of that too. The check you sent was not sufficient. I need more money. The boys need to go to school. And I think personally, just having read all that stuff myself, I think that Joy, I think that's what intensified Joy's emotions for Jack. She wanted that type of connection with a man. And obviously, you know, we've talked about this some, but he cheated on her. He was an alcoholic. He would kind of do a warning, go off and be gone for a while. And so she was kind of a single parent in many ways. I mean, the night that she, you know, sort of caved in and became a Christian, she was by herself. The boys were in bed and she was by herself, you know, sort of face to face with her, you know, the real issue. I think when you read the love sonnets, you know, a lot of people who may not know the backstory will be a little surprised at the strength and the intensity of her emotions and how the coyness kind of affects her. I think it's because deep down she wants so badly to have that type of relationship with a husband, because that's how she views a real marriage, a Christ-filled marriage. And so that's kind of what she wants. So I think that's why we see a lot of frustration in the sonnets, as Don read some today. It's just because I think she understood marriage to be something than what she was experiencing, and she wanted that, and she wanted that so badly that we have these lovely sonnets now to show, you know, how true and how much she desired Lewis, not just as a man on a bus, but as an intellectual and emotional and spiritual connection.
Something I'll talk about more in the second recap is the fact that Dr. Bruce Edwards died before the end of 2015. Prior to that, he was on my show several times. What follows is a clip from the second part of a two-part show that explored a four-volume work he edited about Lewis. This segment is longer than more of my clips because I had him summarize the focus of the third and fourth volumes.
The final two volumes in the series, volume 3 and volume 4, are just as filled with terrific essays and insights, and have the added bonus, I think, of presenting new scholars, younger scholars even, to the worldwide audience of C.S. Lewis. And I would also add that these are international scholars as well, which I think gives added impact to the value of the work. But volume 3 is the volume that's focusing on Lewis as apologist, philosopher, and theologian. And, in some ways, those are disputable terms. Although Lewis had academic work and certainly had published work as an apologist, a philosopher, and a theologian, he would not have wanted to be credited with those vocations. He loved the Bible, he loved the defense of the Christian faith, and he certainly loved good philosophy. But he was not what he considered to be a professional at those things. And, you know, a lot of writers today who write about Lewis seem to go out of their way to point out, oh, but Lewis wasn't, you know, professional in any of these areas. And of course, my attitude is always, but he is so much better than the people who do it professionally. Why wouldn't I want to also hear from him? And I think that's the attitude and the premise with which each of the contributors to this volume work. It's not that they are leaving professional credentials behind, and it's not important, but that Lewis is able to provide insight into those arenas of thought and debate. And I think these essays do a great job of presenting Lewis for the value and the insight he does have to the topics of apologetics, philosophy, and theology. And, we've got some preeminent participants here. You know, Victor Reppert, who teaches philosophy in Arizona, is one of the great expositors of Lewis currently, and I was happy to be able to get Victor to write on the book Miracles, Lewis's book, which is of course very controversial because there are a lot of commentators who assume a lot about Lewis's so-called defeat and his desire to edit Miracles as a result. And I think, again, here's a place where Victor Reppert has a very calm deliberate way of explaining what has happened in Lewis's sort of philosophical career and how that played out. So I think that's a very valuable, just to cite one example. Now, volume four is sort of the summing up kind of volume, the legacy volume, what are we to make of Lewis and his continued impact on not only British and American culture, but, increasingly around the world in places you would not expect, from Russia to Brazil to Japan to China. As his renown and his influence grows, we're going to want to have testimony and critique from around the world. And so I'm glad to say that in this particular volume, we have Marta Garcia de la Puerta commenting about the Inklings abroad, and she's writing from Spain, but she provides us with a terrific overview of how Lewis is received and become a prominent spokesperson in these atypical countries for enjoying and spreading the word about Lewis's work. So this is a volume that gives us a chance to reflect on not only what Lewis was in his time, but how he continues to be an important critic and thinker for the 21st century.
Then in early June, I released a couple of new shows that included Dr. Edwards again, which was actually because of an idea he suggested to me, which was to look back on the 2013 biographies that had come out now that there had been more time to consider them. For the clip I chose, we'll hear him and two other panelists tell about what they look for when they pick a biography in general, and if that's any different when reading a bio on Lewis. First, the late Bruce Edwards shares, and then Charlie Starr, and finally, Crystal Hurd.
Well, I'll start with this. You have to be a good writer and not just a good biographer. We have great researchers. We have great venues for doing further research on Lewis and friends. But I want to know that the person writing this story, this life story, is somebody who is capable, and they don't have to be as good a writer as Lewis was. How many people could live up to that set of qualities? But they have to be able to capture a life and find that life interesting and compelling. And, not everybody can do that.
A partial answer is to say that novices, and you alluded to this in the way you worded your question, novices may want one thing from a biography while experts may want another. I think overall, I want a story that's interesting, and I want to meet the man, meet the woman, whomever the biography is about. I want to meet that person. I want to know something of that person. The experts also want some serious accuracy in the work of the biography, it seems to me. So there's a couple of things to consider anyway as far as what we want in the biography. Primarily for myself, overall, though, I want to meet the person in the biography that I'm reading.
If I'm picking up a specific biography on Lewis versus just another famous person writer, like Charlie mentioned, you have to sort of think of the audience. If you are an expert versus a novice, then you'll already have a lot of the basic information. So you're sort of looking at, okay, what aspects are you approaching Lewis from that are new or different or can provoke, some new insight into his life? Usually, at this point, I like to personally see new information. There's a lot of unpublished stuff. There's a lot of, manuscripts here and there. And it sheds a lot of light into many aspects of Lewis's life, particularly the younger life. So I like to see new information and not exaggerated or hyperbolic, information. I like to see it. Not what someone has construed, but what really comes from, you know, Lewis's life and what's new and interesting about him.
The next new show was released in late June, and it was about two books from Dr. Don King. The first is an edited work of Joy Davidman's poems, and the second is an examination of all of Joy's writings. This clip, separated by a short musical interlude, has him tell about each.
This is not exactly what you might call the collected poems of Joy Davidman, but it's close. And it contains not only her only published volume of poetry, Letters to a Comrade, which appeared in 1938, it also contains another, that book, by the way, has 45 poems in it. But we also included in A Naked Tree the other 30 poems or so that she published during her lifetime. And in addition, again, because of some new material that we have discovered recently, there's another 250 poems that we didn't even know existed that we have now included in A Naked Tree. Part of that grouping of 250 poems includes a 45 sonnet love sequence that Joy wrote to Lewis. I did this study of Joy's writings chronologically. That is, I looked at her earlier writing and went through the last book that she published, as well as some of the poetry that we've discovered since her death. And I think there are four ways in which I hope readers will be influenced by reading my critical interpretation of Joy's work. First of all, I think that if we look at Joy's work chronologically, that at least some readers may decide that her place in the canon of 20th century American literature deserves a bit more attention than it has heretofore received, particularly because of her poetry. For instance, her poems, those I've already mentioned, give evidence of her efficacy as a poet. For instance, she uses irony effectively. Her imagery is evocative and striking, and her subject matter exposes her profound understanding of the human condition. And moreover, her work as a novelist and as a book and theater and movie reviewer is also noteworthy, and it illustrates much about her intellectual, aesthetic, and artistic development. Just to go back to her poetry for a moment, when I first presented Joy's love poems to an audience, this would have been, I think, in 2012, I actually presented information about these new poems, particularly the love sonnets to Lewis, at the Oxford C.S. Lewis Society. And afterwards, a member of the faculty there at one of the colleges came up to me and said, you know, when this poetry becomes public, it's certainly going to boost Joy's place as a 20th century American poet. So one of the things I hope this book does is, in fact, give support to that idea. That is, Joy ought to be looked at, Joy Davidman, ought to be looked at a bit more seriously as a 20th century poet. Part of the reason I don't think that's happened is that so little of her poetry was available. As I said earlier in our discussion today, only about 75 poems appeared during her lifetime. That's not really enough of a mass of poems for someone to be considered, I think, a significant poet. But this new grouping of another 250 poems that we have, I think, bolsters the contention that Joy is a very important poet in the 20th century. Secondly, going through her work chronologically shows us something of her religious, her philosophical, and her intellectual journey from secular Judaism to atheism, to communism, and to Christianity.
Dr. Devin Brown, who has been on several shows in years past, was back to tell about a project he was involved in called Discussing Mere Christianity.
So a couple years back, the C.S. Lewis Estate began to wonder whether or not people might need, I'll just say, some help, some encouragement in reading Mere Christianity. It's almost 75 years old. If we do the broadcast talks version, the original versions that Lewis gave over the BBC in the 1940s during World War II, and the fact that it's British, not American, makes it a little bit difficult for the average American Christian to read on his or her own. It's not impossible, but I think it needs to be unpacked a little bit, given those two distances of time and culture. So they begin looking for people that might be willing to unpack it in a way. And so we've put together a team that I think really does a great job of bringing not only Mere Christianity to life, but bringing Lewis and his impact to life. Eric Metaxas was chosen to host the video. And video is a key component. As people who go to church now know, videos are widely used in teaching. They have, you know, word and music, I'll just say, need an image. And so they've done a great job of doing that. So discussing Mere Christianity has always been conceived of two parts that go together, a paper study guide. And truth be told, it's an 8-session study guide. It goes with the 8-session video DVD, where we look at what I would say are some of the highlights of Mere Christianity. People who want to go through the entire book will find that we don't hit the entire book. That would be too massive of a project, although perhaps if this discussing Mere Christianity goes well, there might be a part two where we take another 8 sessions and look at some of the things we didn't cover. Anyway, make a long story short, I got asked to write the paper study guide to help with the locations in Oxford and then to help with the script for the documentary.
Finally, the last podcast I'll recap here is about an edited work that I spoke with Carolyn Curtis about, entitled Women and C.S. Lewis. Here she tells about the scope of the book, and then I share part of her answer about whether or not the book is just for women.
Women and C.S. Lewis is a compilation book, meaning it has chapters by nearly 30 authors. The book's voice is what's called popular rather than scholarly, and although we think it will be a great resource to people in the academic world, we really expect the majority of readers to be just plain fans of C.S. Lewis. People who were, you know, raised on Narnia or who read Narnia to their children, people who love Lewis's science fiction, or people who just love the simple way that Lewis described the walk of faith. Just regular fans, regular people.
With a title like Women and C.S. Lewis, is this book just for women, or why should men be interested in it?
That's a great question, William. It probably does sound like a book for women readers, but actually we expect a huge population of male readers, and I'll see if I can explain why. I think I'll use Eric Metaxas as an example. Our publishing house used his endorsement on the cover of the book, and it goes like this. Thanks, someone needed to write this book. So why would Eric Metaxas say that about women and C.S. Lewis? I think I know the reason, William, and I'll see if I can articulate it. It's because, ultimately, this book is about the biblical standard, the biblical model of manhood, as expressed in the life and literature of the man named C.S. Lewis. So how Lewis related to women does matter. How Lewis portrayed girls and women in his novels does matter. What Lewis wrote and said about male-female relationships on so many levels does matter. And that's, of course, because men look to Lewis as a role model. Men see Lewis as, you know, wise and witty and deep and engaging on just so many aspects of life. And both men and women see Lewis as an example of a person of either gender who is greatly changed by God and greatly used by God. So, a very legitimate question becomes, how did Lewis understand and relate to women before his conversion to Christ versus after his conversion? And the real heart of that question is this: how does God change and mold and develop a boy who was, frankly, a little bit of a prig at some points in his life? And other descriptions I'll try to tastefully leave out, into a man, and by that I really specifically mean a male adult. What values does God develop into such a male adult who he wants to use as mightily as he used Lewis? And how do those values play out in that man's relationships and also in his life's work?
Well, thanks for joining me for this first of 2 episodes showcasing excerpts from the first half of new shows from 2015. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com to be able to hear any of the entire programs, as well as to hear any new ones that I have in the future. Well, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of All About Jack. Thanks for listening.